Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
John Norton, who's an emeritus professor of the public understanding of technology, an author and a journalist, and founder of the Nindaru Research Centre on Technology and Democracy in the University of Cambridge.
Thanks so much for being with us, John. And my opening question is to ask, what's currently on your mind? What's preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you?
Well, what's on what might loosely be called my mind is a question. Looking at the world we're currently inhabiting, my question is, how do we get here? How in God's name did we make such a mess of it? And because I've written a few books in my time, and each book was kind of scratching an itch. Many, many years ago, I wrote The History of the Internet, partly because I was baffled and annoyed by the extent to which the mainstream world seemed ignorant of it and ignored it. And it was triggered by a conversation with a posh newspaper editor in the UK, who said, in the tones used normally by aristocratic landowners talking to their kind of coachman, he said something like this: "Don't you think, dear boy, that this internet thingy is the how should I put it, citizen band radio de nos jours?" And this is way back in the early 90s. And I looked at him and I thought, "You poor sap, you have no idea what's coming." So I wrote the history of it. And then years later, I was very struck by a conversation I had with a senior. I mean, senior government minister in the Blair government, who was notionally responsible in some respects for the internet. And to my astonishment, I found that this guy thought that the internet and the web were the same thing. And a few weeks later, I met Tim Berners-Lee at a conference, and I said, "Tim, this is what I discovered." And he says, "It's worse than that." He said, "There are got maybe 1 billion people in the world now who think that Facebook is the internet." And at that point, I wrote a book, which is From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, what you really need to know about the net. And now I'm banging my head on this question of how did we get here?
So it sounds like there's a real itch waiting to be scratched. You've already
Yeah.
addressed pretty large questions with those two books, which are very prominent and well known. I think one 2000, the other 2014, something like that.
Yeah, that's good. No, 2012 was the second one.
2012, sorry. But taking on how did we get here is going to require your thinking about the world's ruling class and its idiocies, isn't it?
No, it's it. I think that's the wrong level. I mean, essentially, what I would like to do anyway is to create an intelligible and hopefully accurate narrative of how Western societies, at any rate, went from the shock of the Second World War to a time now when it's not clear that liberal democracies, at any rate, will be able to survive the technologies that we have created in the last kind of 20 years.
So you
And
see, sorry, go ahead.
that's not a story of individual villains.
Yeah.
It's a story about has to be a story about massive social changes and particularly changes in democracy and in capitalism. I mean, if you wanted to, not in a nutshell, what my kind of suspicion is that if the human race survives beyond the next 500 years, and there still are historians, the historians of 500 or 1,000 years from now will look back on this period, the post-war explosion of liberal democracy that we all think of as normal, and what it will look like to them is a kind of little blip on the historical record. So that's my general stance.
So the notion that there is a gradual unfurling towards liberty and representative democracy that takes place over time and over different places, But that, in a sense, is the end. That's the telos. That's the final point of the evolution of politics, is probably wrong. It's a Whiggish narrative. And instead, what you see is that this is, as you say, a blip, a moment,
Yeah, I
not
mean,
a sterling narrative.
I'm deeply fond of Francis Fukuyama in a way, and I think he's often maliciously misinterpreted. But and I can understand why, for a time, that sort of Whiggish narrative about the liberal democracy that we had was, the epitome of human of as were political evolution. I could see why. That for a brief moment that looked like a plausible conjecture. But it was a bit like other kind of glib misrepresentations, like Thomas Friedman talking about the world being flat and the glorification, the belief that globalization was, as it were, preordained as the way in which human society would evolve, and so on. It's always dangerous when you're living through something that's where there is something really serious going on by way of change, to make any understanding about it. Sorry, I've just had to turn down a call. It's what Adam Tooze talks about in terms of trying to think in media res when you're in the middle of something. How do you make sense of it? And we're all trying to do that at the moment, with greater and lesser degrees of plausibility, I think. And that's tricky. I mean, one of the things that I've been a newspaper journalist, a newspaper columnist, I should say, and an academic all my working life. My old boss, Conor Cruise O'Brien, used to say, because he had the same kind of background, he used to say, "Oh, I see, you've got a foot in both graves." There is this thing that we have to avoid, which Michael Mann, the sociologist, once characterized as the abiding sin of journalism, which is, I think Michael Mann called it the sociology of the last 5 minutes. And I think that's what, those of us who are stuck in this part of the forest, we need to remember that all the time. Humility goes a long way,
For
and
sure.
there's not much of it around in the commentariat.
Thinking of what you describe as this period since the Second World War, it's what many people refer to as the technological sublime, the moment when the supposed philosophical bifurcation of the beautiful from the awesome, the gorgeous from the powerful, the calm and loving side of nature to its sublime force is captured in captivating ways by the sorts of technology that I'm using to speak to you today, where design meets computing power, right? And that this was something that didn't happen so much before the war, though some motor cars might be other examples, and of course, some architecture and engineering might. I wonder about your view on that and the significance of new technology and technology and design to the situation we're in, the state we're in. How much of it is determined by technology?
Well, I'm not a determinist, but I understand why people are. When I'm asked to describe myself now, I say I'm a recovering utopian. Be because I discovered this technology early as a young academic. And I remember the early days of the internet, and I know some of the people who built it. And I understand, like them, I really thought that it was going to be a world-transforming, beneficial kind of change. And the technology had and still has the capacity to do that. But somewhere along the line, from the beginning to this longed-for utopia, or perhaps naively expected utopia, it got captured. That's what happened. And the funny thing is that this is an old story. Tim Wu wrote a great book years ago called The Master Switch, in which he chronicles the rise and evolution of the great communications technologies of the 20th century in the US in particular. The first thing was a telephone, second was broadcast radio, third was movies. And in each case, when they emerged, they were chaotic. They encouraged, and creative as well, they encouraged utopian hopes, usually optimistically naive hopes. And in due course, each was captured. In each case, by entrepreneurs, creative, sometimes almost genius entrepreneurs, who made potential customers a promise, which is that we will sort out the chaos and we'll make this thing dependable and usable by you, rather than by the masochists who are the normal early adopters. And then what happens is that we buy the, and Wu calls it eventually it came to be known as the Wu cycle. It starts creative and utopian and all the rest of it. Then it gets captured. And then that's it. And the question at the end of Tim's book was, will this happen to the internet? And we now know the answer, that it did happen. The technology retains all of the capacities that we thought that excited us at the beginning, all of them. In fact, more of them, because it has become more sophisticated over the years. For example, by the technology that you and I are using now. But in general, it has been used for purposes that, while delighting and enthralling users, it's controlled by entities which are, in my opinion, profoundly antisocial and dangerous. By which I mean large tech corporations, which currently seem to be, at this moment, seem to be still beyond the reach of liberal democracies. So one of the existential questions that I have been thinking about for a few years is, can liberal democracies actually control this? And it's an interesting question because we know it can be controlled. We have a really wonderful working system in China. The question is, can our systems, rule of law, corporate lobbying, hollowed out states, and so on, can we do it? And we're in the middle of having a go at it, and we'll see. If we don't, then we will have some kind of illiberal democracy. It won't be a proper democracy because we have unregulated and really formidable powers loose in it without control. You simply can't have a democracy like that. You can have something else, like you can have an illiberal democracy like Orban has in Hungary, but you can't have the one that we pretend we have.
John, I want to throw you back at the risk of jeopardizing your recovery to those early utopian days. I'm assuming this was in your period as a systems engineer. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, yeah.
So, can you take us back to what seemed like the grand possibilities, some of which, as you're saying, are still alive today and others of which may come to pass? But what was the kind of conversation you guys were having? I presume this is in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, if you had access to the internet in the period from 1983 when it became a public thing, although it was for 10 years from 83 to 93, it was largely a parallel universe as far as the ordinary world was concerned. Then what you saw was there had never been a communications network like it before because it was built on two axioms. One axiom was that there was no central ownership or control. And the second axiom was that it should be a very primitive piece of technology. It should do only one thing. And the one thing it did was to take a data packet in at one of its edges and do its level best, but not guarantee that it would succeed, level's best to deliver that data packet to its destination at some other edge of the network. It became known as the end-to-end principle. But what it actually meant was that we created, for the first time in history, we created an architecture for what Barbara Schrey later called an architecture for permissionless innovation. Right? Nobody controlled this thing, but if you were smart enough, if you wanted to do something with data packets, and you were smart enough to write the necessary software and protocols and other things, then the internet would do it, would deliver those packets for you, no questions asked. The packets could contain anything, as far as the they could be an email conversation, that could be a love letter, that could be a report of an article, it doesn't matter, it could be pornography and worse. The internet was entirely agnostic about that. It would just do it. Now, that was an amazing achievement, and because there'd never been anything like that in human history before. And it's not surprising, many of us thought, wow, okay. For example, I've worked on, I've written for newspapers for a long time. I started writing for newspapers when they were produced by the hot metal process. I span the whole gamut of this from the beginning. And there was a time when, first of all, you had magazine editors who would say, or newspaper editors say, well, actually, you may think you're as smart as hell, but actually, we don't like this stuff. Right? Go to hell. If it got in, and for some reason the print unions were pissed off about it, then it didn't get out, and so on. So we lived in a world of gatekeepers in a very, very simple media ecosystem. I like to think that that media, the pre-internet and the pre-internet media ecosystem was a very simple ecosystem. It was rather like a desert ecosystem. Small number of predators, not much biodiversity, and so on. And then we could see immediately, this is going to sideline all of that. And that seemed to be like a good idea at the time. And it was magnificently expressed really by Yochai Benkler in a wonderful book, The Wealth of Networks. Absolutely wonderful exposition of this. And it was not unreasonable at the time if you were if you're an optimistic person and you believed in the capacity of technology to do good, that this is something really special. And it was, and it is. But
When did you start to recover from your utopianism, Prof?
sometime in 2009, 2010.
So you kept the flame going. You felt positively all the way through the 90s and the first part of or the first decade of the century.
Yes. And for example, I express that I've been a blogger forever. Forever, in internet terms,
And
myself.
you keep doing it. Your last entry was yesterday, I think I saw.
Yeah, I do it once a day. Well, once, three times a week. And I've done it forever. And it still has all those magical capabilities. Every morning I switch on my phone at 6 o'clock, whenever, and what comes through is a torrent of really interesting stuff from people I follow who are smart and thoughtful and sophisticated and so on. It's just bloody wonderful. But that's not the same as plugging into the walled gardens of Twitter stroke X, Meta Instagram stroke Threads, and so on. And that's what most of the world sees. And yet I see continually every morning, I see the potential of this thing still going. But most people don't know about that, and they're locked out of it. Well, they're locked out. They're not locked out of it as much as they don't want to go there somehow, which baffles me. But
Was there an incident or a technology or a set of, pardon me, John, incidents or technologies, Prof, in 2009, 2010 that tipped you into this more dystopian worldview?
well, I can remember the moment when I can remember very vividly the moment when the first doubt appeared in my mind. I have a friend, James Mayall, who's a wonderful, wise, very wise academic. He was a professor of international studies in Cambridge. But before that, he lived a varied life. He'd been a British military officer and so on, and he was one of the wisest people I knew. He knew nothing about this technology, but I was a member of a fairly elite group in the middle to late 90s, called the Internet Political Economy Forum, and we used to meet in Seattle, and sometimes we had meetings on a lovely kind of research retreat on Friday Island in the Puget Sound. This is an absolutely idyllic location for meeting, and collected at those meetings were people who were at the heart of this revolution, people like Vint Cerf, and even God damn it, John Perry Barlow sometimes. Okay, and at one time, one of these meetings, I asked James, my friend James, to come with me, and he did. And one morning, a beautiful sunny morning, that we had this fevered debate about the utopian possibilities of this stuff, and at 11 o'clock, James said, oh, "Look, I need a cigar. Let's go out." And we sat on the deck smoking cigars. And he said to me at one point, "Do you think that this technology is really going to have the revolutionary impact that you and your colleagues think?" And I said, "Yes, James, I do." And he didn't say anything. He just puffed on the cigar. And after a while, I got pissed off and I said, "Well, what do you think, James?" And he smiled and he said, "We'll see, dear boy. We'll see." That's the first moment ever. And it started a train of thought that made me.
The first seed of doubt. Yeah.
And he
Interesting.
was a very wise old bird. He really
Right.
was.
And John Perry Barlow was a true believer, there's no doubt about that, and a very powerful spokesperson for that Cypertarian perspective.
He was.
Very, very powerful, very effective, and idealistic at the same time as pugnacious, and always an interesting blend, I think.
No, he was, in that sense, a very attractive person. The one thing I learned about John Perry is that it's never share a platform with him, because you're on a platform, you've got two speakers, and the speakers have been allowed 45 minutes. John Perry goes first. I went second, and I got 10 minutes at the end, because once he got going, he was unstoppable. But he was, an inspiring figure. And
Yeah.
of course, and also that it helped if you had been an addict of the Grateful Dead.
I had the same experience 20, nearly 25 years ago as you.
Okay, right. You know what it's like. Yeah.
Indeed. Funnily enough, one of the interesting things was that I was teaching at New York University at the time, and he had a child who was about to go to NYU. So he was very keen to talk about that, and much happier talking to me about that than anything else. But one of the things that excited him was that his, I forget if it was a son or a daughter, was going to study with Neil Postman. And I said, now, Neil, whatever other virtues or vices one may associate with him, is not exactly your line of thinking, old boy. And John Perry Barlow said, yes, but he's one of us. And I didn't, I knew I wasn't one of us, but I didn't know who we were, as it were. But apparently, his child was in safe hands with Neil Postman. It certainly would have been an antidote to Daddy's position. Of that one can be sure.
I bet, yeah. And also Postman, Neil Postman was one of my heroes, but he was a pre-internet creature,
Oh,
really.
absolutely. You know,
But
he regarded as properly Kantian to write with a fountain pen.
yeah. Well, I write with a fountain pen, by the way. I won't hear anything against fountain pens. But no, but he was lovely, and remember he wrote that wonderful book, Technopoly, The Worship of Technology. And the disappearance of childhood,
Yeah.
which is dead relevant to internet, to Instagram now, and TikTok.
No, and in fact, in the early 70s, he wrote really radical educational material.
Yes, yes,
Really
yes.
radical, really innovative.
Yeah, that's true.
That I think are largely forgotten now, but may well be regarded in the cooler light of day as a major contribution. But obviously, Amusing Ourselves to Death was the huge international hit and multiply translated. So I really appreciate your story about the retreat you were on with your colleague and friend and the questions he raised. And it's also an interesting one about how one thinks differently. One of the things I really appreciate about your columns, because they are part of my, I guess it's Sunday mornings, right? They're the Observer. One of the things I appreciate about them is that when I read them, I feel as though you are open to surprise. You're open to newness. And one of the difficulties for me as a person on the far left of politics is that partly for economic reasons, most of the progressive journalism that I read, it's really columns, it's not journalism, but it's also not often terribly open to uncertainty and new ideas in the way that it should be. And regrettably, that's something I get more from The Economist, actually, for
Well,
all its
it's interesting
ideological differences.
well, sure, but it's interesting you mentioned The Economist because I've been a subscriber to The Economist forever.
Right.
I really love its journalism. And I think that whoever writes the editorials ought to be sent away on a correction course or something because it's kind of neoliberal kind of stuff all the
No,
time.
it's just
But
claptrap.
the great irony of The Economist is because it's commercially very successful, it can afford to employ really good journalists, and secondly, to give them the space that they need. It's a
My
miraculous.
father was a foreign correspondent at The Economist for 25 years. So we would, I would wake up, I remember really well my mother in the mornings waking up and finding that she had taken down in shorthand a telegram that had been phoned from The Economist in the middle of the night, which she would then translate for my father. He would spend the day writing his copy, and then he and I would go to the post office in the evening with his typed telegram copy to be sent off. It really was a very different, I mean, it was a fascinating experience as a child to feel as though you were part of it, not intellectually, but getting in the car and going to the post office. And there was always one guy on the late shift who would stay there, knowing that copy would come from for whatever reason. But I agree with you. I think its reportage is excellent. Many of its columns are really not very good because they are so ideologically driven by kind of, I hate unions and I hate this and I hate that. And people who are called things like sociologists and anthropologists, they don't want to know about, they only know about certain forms of knowledge and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that brings me to ask you, because as I say, I'm a big fan of your columns.
Thank you.
That brings me as in part because also you're prepared to say to people at the bottom, here's an interesting thing to read. Go and have a look at this, which you also do on your blog. I wanted to ask you what changes you've experienced working in this other half of you, if you like, not the academic, but the journalist, the sorts of alterations you've experienced technologically, but also in terms of ownership and themes and all the rest of it over your time.
Well, I suppose I was colored by the fact that from 1987 to 1995, I was the Observer's TV critic. And that was an interesting time in all kinds of reasons. But one of them was that when I stopped doing it, it was because I had seen how broadcast media were going to were inevitably going to decline. Because in that ecosystem, until the mid-90s, the biggest beast in the media ecosystem was broadcast TV. And I had this wonderful period when I was a critic of this at its kind of late flowering best. I'm not a golden age guy or anything like that, but it was true that it was absolutely wonderful. And the other thing that was wonderful about writing for The Observer was that I was given real fr I had real freedom. At that time, the average citizen in the UK, actually the UK doesn't have citizens, it only has subjects. but we'll leave that aside. But the average subject in it was spending 22 hours a week watching TV. And I was a TV critic of a major newspaper, and I was watching perhaps three shows a week, which and I had the freedom to do that. And the poor editor, Donald Trelford, who was a member of the Garrick Club at the time, he used to go to lunch in the Garrick on Monday and be set upon by all the media moguls, the TV moguls, saying, "Why, in the name of God, doesn't your bloody critic watch anything interesting?" And Donald once said to me, very sweetly, he said, "John, sometimes would you mind watching writing about shows that people actually watch?" Because I was following my nose and being interested in things that, I liked the higher end stuff. But it was a wonderful experience. But it gave me a kind of an insight into what that industry was like. And I could see in it was the kind of apotheosis of the old media ecosystem, both print and broadcast, of this kind of a set of entitled males, usually funded by lunatics of various kinds with unimaginable amounts of money then, but nothing like the unimaginable amounts of money now. And of course, I saw the whole transition from that your father's world, where you wrote your column and then you went along and put it in the post. I did all of that, and my kids saw all of that, like you did. And I remember, for example, another sort of way of illustrating the difference between The Observer and other kinds of publications was, for a while, my editor-in-chief was Conor Cruise O'Brien, a major figure, a major world figure in all kinds of ways, a man with astonishing talents and large flaws. But he was something else. Anyway, and he used to tell a story against himself in a way. He was somewhere in Europe, and he had a weekly column, and he was phoning it in to the Observer copy taker on the end of the phone. And at one point, it went like this. Cruiser said, "The atmosphere was redolent of fin de siècle Vienna." That's French, FIND. And the copy taker said, "Dr. O'Brien, I think you should know that a copy taker on the Observer would know what the French for the end of the century is." Now, can you imagine that conversation anywhere else, now?
No, totally
Okay.
wonderful.
That was a world that was that's the world that was. And then the ecosystem changed from being, as it were, a simple ecosystem like that of the desert, to being a rainforest, which is what we have now. And just as in all other as in rainforests, there are now huge beasts as well, and they're roaming around, and there's a huge biodiversity as well. I mean, just think of the number of blogs there are, or the number of so-called bloggers on X or Twitter, or
Yes, I hear what you're saying, but in terms of the metaphor you've chosen, people are also talking about news deserts, thinking about the destruction of local journalism, regional journalism in Britain, in the United States, in Colombia, in many parts of the world. And where, and I wonder, and I think Jim Carrey, amongst others, was onto this before he passed away. Nearly 20 years ago now, what happens when the experience of people living in countries where there is a big diversity of news in terms of literally its topography, where it comes from, when it ceases to be the case that they know reporters, when ordinary people in not very big cities can see a reporter at a church or a synagogue or a wedding or a parent-teacher night or a sports day. Not just doing his or her job, but as a parent or as a believer or as a participant. And whether or not the erosion of that experience of not people working for the Observer, right, or the Sunday Times, but people working for the Leicester Mercury, it ceases to happen. Whether that relates to this sense of derision of journalism as a profession. The way in which, in so many of these countries, the public standing of reporters has dropped precipitously from the 70s to the 90s and on to today. The lack of everyday familiarity and the sense that the news is coming from, people living in North London, to use a kind of square expression that the Tory press and the Tories use. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I'm on the same wavelength. I think that one of the requirements for a functioning liberal democracy is local news media, in particular local newspapers, not online. Okay, now that's the first point. I think that it has been an unmitigated disaster that the way in which advertising was leached away from them into the coffers of a number of huge tech corporations is at the root of it. That's the first bit of it. Okay. Now, the second thing is that, and I've written about this, for example, it seemed to me that an Australian government, which in other respects might have been seen as a kind of quasi-lunatic fringe outfit, had one good idea, which was that the giant tech giants should actually pay some kind of levy to support. Now the problem is the levy in that case was going to support Rupert Murdoch's outfit, but never mind. But I wrote about this, and you have never seen the kind of blowback I got from lots of people in the institute, techies, people who are fond of social media and so on. Why the hell should Google and Facebook be paying to support newspapers which are kind of going bust because they haven't any money and all the rest of it? And at that point, I could see the reality of a fundamental truth, in my view, because in my story about how we got here, one of the things that plays a big role in this story is ideology. And ideology determines how you think when you don't know you're thinking. Right? And in the case of the discussion about whether these tech giants should be somehow supporting local newspapers and local journalism, the fundamental question is not what will happen as a result of having the tech industry do what it likes. The answer is what does democracy require from these giants? And one of the answers is it requires some siphoning off of the riches they are earning to support institutions that are important for local democracy. I live in Cambridge, which is in some cases a kind of crackpot bubble of tech optimism, and a place where, as a result, the only place where house prices are higher is in London. Okay, this is a small market town once. But the point is that it's very interesting to see how refreshing it is. There's still a local newspaper here. And boy, is it interesting, because they go to the Magistrates' Court, they go to the council meetings, and there's nothing like that. I mean, there's a lot of nonsense about, Facebook groups and so on doing it. It's not anything like it. There's no substitute for having reporters going to things, listening to them, writing them down, and publishing them in things that people actually read. And that's what democracy requires. But we have lived it through an ideological transmission in which just to say that seems to be unthinkable.
Well, John, moving from your life as a reporter, but not leaving it behind, or columnist, in your academic life, have you ever run into headwinds caused by people who think academics shouldn't be writing journalism? It's okay to pen the occasional op-ed about or column about new research, but this is not the done thing. Has that ever happened to you? It's not objective, it's not science, it's not the right conduct.
Sure, but to be honest, it's never bothered me. I mean, one of the things that was very funny was that my academic colleagues thought that although I wasn't obviously a good academic, I must be a good journalist. And on the other hand, the journalist thought, well, he's not much of a hack, but he must be a good academic. So there was no But so that was the first bit of it. The second bit of it is, of course, that there was a small matter of I've always earned more from journalism than I ever earned as being an academic. And that rankles too, because among other things, it meant I had what is known in the trade as fuck you money. And that there's nothing, I mean, I had tenure as well. There's nothing to beat that in terms of. So I've always felt immune to it. There was one problem, which was that I have a namesake, nice man, same name, who specialized in a different area of journalism. One stage he wrote for some magazine and he was reviewing porn videos. And at that point, some of my colleagues thought, this is a
He's
wrong
gone
line.
too far this time. Well, if it's any consolation, John, 25 years ago, I was on my way to a conference in DC and I had my name tag on without realizing. Anyway, a guy came over to me on the metro and said, "Is your name Toby Miller?" I said, "Yes." He said, "That's my name too. I'm a type A personality. I look up my name every day on, some software engine, I forget which. And sometimes there's more about you than me. I don't like that." So anyway, I thought, that's interesting. I must find out who this guy is. And he was a very prominent internet security person.
All right.
But apart from me, the other one was a porn actress in
Wow.
LA named Toby Miller, who became very distinguished because
Wow.
she led the campaign for mandatory use of condoms in heterosexual pornography shot in California.
Atta girl.
But she's since disappeared from sight, and he's disappeared from sight.
Right.
So I
And
no
there
longer
are you,
have
and
a
there are you
type
still going. And here, there
A.
you are still going.
But
Wow.
in all seriousness, no, I appreciate that because I do think it's interesting also in terms of forms of writing. I wanted to ask you about that. The way one writes a column is different from the way one writes a scientific journal article, which can be different from the way one writes a humanities or social sciences journal article. The way one writes a trade book can be different from the way one writes a more scholarly one. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience of shifting gears, or has that not been your experience?
Well, of course, in some ways it has. First of all, I'm always amused by the way in which academia refers to, and you can sense the kind of somebody holding their nose and saying, trade books. And my response to that is always, oh, you mean books that actually sell and are read by people? Okay, I'm all in favor of trade books, and some of my colleagues have written wonderful trade books. I mean, whereas many of them have written monographs which had five readers over 20 years. That's wonderful, maybe, but there you go. But so I'm in favor of spreading ideas as widely as they can be. And I have some wonderful colleagues who do that. For example, David Runciman. I've worked with David for years. And he's a miraculous kind of communicator, and he's a very high status academic as well. But he can do it. And one of the most important books I've seen in the last couple of years is the book by Darren Daron Acemoglu and was it Simon, I can't remember the second name. But the one on power and progress. It's an absolutely magisterial work. It basically surveys the last 1,000 years of technology and reaches the conclusion that most of the time, although technology has obviously improved the human condition, for a long time, with only one or two exceptions, the vast majority of the rewards from that go to a small, powerful elite. That's the story of technology and society over 1,000 years, and I see no possibility of it being any different in ours. But that's a trade book written by great academics, Simon Johnson, I think, is terrific. I'm all in favor. David Runciman has a book on a recent book on the state as a superintelligence and corporations as superintelligences. And again, it's remorselessly readable and very profound. I've never seen the proper distinction about it. And I think I get tired of I really get tired of the arguments about this. I'm all in favor of things that communicate well.
Now, I wonder if I could also take you back a bit, but not too far back, to when you were at the Open University. Now, Prof, the plurality of listeners to this are based in is based in the United States, but nowhere near the majority. So it's about 28% in the US, about 23% in the UK, and the rest in different parts of the world. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, because I think it would be of real interest to people, about the OU as a place to work, but also the chair that you held, which I think was called something like Public Understanding of Technology, if I got that right. An enormously important title and topic. So could you tell us a little bit about the OU and your time there, and a little bit about the chair that you held?
Okay. Well, the first thing about the Open University is that, in my opinion, it was the best idea Harold Wilson's government had. They had, because it dates from the 1960s. It was originally an idea of Michael Young's. But the context was, in the 1960s, if you, as a kid, had missed getting to university when you were 18, then you had missed the boat for good. Okay, there was nothing, almost no possibilities of a third level education if you'd missed that boat. And the idea was that a Labour government could do something about that. And the idea started with the idea of an institution that provided third level education, but without having rigorous entry requirements. Initially, it was called the University of the Air. But the strange thing is that the government delivered on it, and Wilson had the intelligence to put Jenny Lee, who was an Aaron Bevin's widow, and who was had real fire in her belly about this and the rest of it, and it was set up in late 1960s, and I joined it in 1972. It was the most innovative education institution in the UK for generations. But just to give you an example of how different it was, for various reasons, which I won't bore you with, but I was originally, I thought I was going to be a journalist. I was working for the New Statesman under Dick Crossman and so on. But I had a special kind of expertise based on my research, which was the application of engineering modeling techniques to economic systems. And there was a group of innovative academics in the OU who wanted to write a series of new courses on systems. Systems analysis, that kind of stuff, systems modeling. And they wanted somebody who wasn't an economist to write about economic systems. And so I got, the, they asked me as a consultant. And my first meeting I went to was in the campus of this new university in Milton Keynes. And it was in the department was housed in one of the wartime RAF huts on the campus at the time. And I went in, I knew nobody. There were these group of academics. And they had a problem, and they were talking about it. So I sat in the corner and listened. And the problem they had was that they had decided that for these four systems courses, there should be a residential, 1 week residential school for students on the course. And at that time, most of the British university sector was very snooty about this open university, you know, and all kinds of jokes about you get an honours degree if you had a colour television, that kind of crap.
Sounds
Okay.
cool.
Sounds cool. But that was the attitude. Okay. And it was turning out that these people were finding it hard to find a university, which in the summer when it's empty, certainly didn't want their money to put these kind of hicks, on. Okay. So this is the problem. I'm sitting there. And then they had come up with if they couldn't get the university to agree to them, what were they going to do? What they were going to do, they were going to rent a cruise liner for the summer. Okay. And I'm sitting there and thinking, Jesus, there is no educational institution in the UK or anywhere else who would think like this. And I thought, and then they offered me a job and I thought I'll come to it.
I'll do it. And I guess Silvio Berlusconi was going to do the singing on the boat.
Who knows? Right. But alternatively, there might have had to have been a harem to justify it, because anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is that, but that's, a, these people were serious. They were very radical. And it turned out to be an astonishing institution, because it had reach and muscle in ways that no other university institution had. And when I worked there, I did three things that were insignificant. One of them was with one or two colleagues, we decided that the foundation course in technology needed to be shifted from what it was before. It was called the man-made world, and that revealed the problem. And we created a radical new foundation course in technology with the title Living with Technology. Okay, that it 8 to 10,000 students a year,
Wow.
ran for 10 years, which meant that I had a significant, I was able to have a significant impact on the way in which 80,000 people thought about technology. And they still write to me. That
Do they?
nowhere else could you do that.
Yeah.
We started with Martin Weller and another colleague. We started what is effectively the world's first major online course. It was called You, Your Computer, and the Net. And we decided to use narrative techniques in teaching technology in it. And it had 12,000 students every time we ran it.
Wow.
Now, nowhere else can you have that kind of stuff.
No.
I wanted to give my students on the foundation course. I eventually said we decided that they had to have access to a PC because this is the beginning of the PC world, and that was ferociously controversial because the OU was founded on the basis that there should be no kind of requirements for people to enter it. And then we seem to be breaching the openness of it and the rest of it. We stuck at it, and eventually the government coughed up enough money to provide a big pool of loan machines for students. Pretty okay. So, but the funny thing of all is, we also wanted to give students free software, and at that time the software package we wanted was produced by an American company called Ashton Tate, and eventually they sent their European and Middle Eastern salesmen to the campus. And this stuff sold at the time for a kind of around £250 or something like that, which was then was real money. And this we had this conversation with this guy, and he said, "Well, we could let you have that for maybe you shouldn't have it for maybe £100." And we indicated that this was a non-starter. And then he said, "Yeah, by the way, how many licenses would you need?" And we said, "We start with 20,000." And you've never seen he looked like the guy in P.G. Woodhouse's thing where he's picking daisies on the down line. He's just received the 415 back of the net, back of the okay. What do we wind up paying? I think it was £5 a copy. That's muscle
Yes.
deployed in the interest of education. And it was exhilarating to be able to do it. Absolutely exhilarating. And eventually we had 250,000 people online. This is a completely different order of magnitude. But it's a wonderful, it was a great place to work. Really great.
It's nice to hear somebody speak positively about their experience as an academic.
Well, I'm lucky. I've had a really lovely time. But it's harder now because most universities are becoming, they've become sort of neoliberal.
Oh,
It's not fun to
undoubtedly.
be, there's a lot of precarity in academic life now and so on.
So I have two more questions for you, if I may, Prof,
Yeah, sure.
and then give you the opportunity, should you wish to add anything to what we've said. Yeah. After I've asked my two questions. So my first question is a story of Britain and computing. It's a story that I often read, which says things like Britain was a world leader after, during the war and after the war, and it's tragic that all of that was lost. The BBC was a great innovator in computing in the 1980s. All of that was lost. What happened? What went wrong? I wonder if you could either support that narrative or put some holes in it.
I think what went wrong is bad framing. The truth of the matter is the UK is a small country, right? And Europe is a bigger place, but it's got lots of different languages. The US is a very, very large internal market, and they all speak, roughly speaking, the same language. So it was always likely to be the case that, especially in technologies that spread like this, that can spread because they're, I mean, it's all software at any rate, it's all thought stuff. You think it up and write it down, and there it is. So, and there was and continues to be a great reservoir of that of talent, but there's no in order to turn stuff from ideas into products that figure in the GDP, you need mass markets, and they didn't exist in the UK, and that's still the case. For example, think of Google of DeepMind, one of the most interesting companies in the post-war period by a mile. It's no longer a British company. Why? Because Google bought it for £400 million, $400 million perhaps. Okay, so and from time immemorial, for a time, ARM was the one exception. Computer, the chip design company in Cambridge, which sprang from the BBC Micro. That's been a wonderful, that's an absolutely wonderful firm, but it's no longer a British firm because in the end, the pressures of shareholder capitalism. A friend of mine was a big founder and investor in ARM, and he said to me that the day it was sold, the way it was acquired by what's it called, that SoftBank, was it? Was the saddest day of his life, even though he probably was £100 million a bit richer that day. So I think part of it is the fact that this is a small offshore island.
Question of scale. Also, of course, having a military that works very closely with universities, which is very much the US story,
Yes. Yeah.
and with massive seed funding for potential military applications, but also with all sorts of commercial applications. Just look at this critter here, the cell phone. So, no, thank you for that. I appreciate it. So, in a sense, what I was alluding to with my version of a story was right, but I didn't have an explanation, which you've given. So thank you.
Oh, okay. Right.
So my last question is to ask what form of intervention you could see as working on the part of liberal democracies. You gave the Australian example, although, of course, in the all given over to the hands of a dirty digger. But what would be a means whereby the European Union, as a very big, very rich set of democracies, more or less, could change things in terms of where we're headed with technology, or also a very big country like the United States? What could they do to save themselves?
Well, the first thing is a spot of ideological hygiene. We have spent, we, I'd say that liberal democracies have spent 70 years or whatever to building a world which is designed to prioritize the interests of corporations. That's what we've been doing. And we've been doing it because the post-war New Deal stroke Keynesian mindset started to break in 1970, and it was replaced by a set of ideas that Friedrich Hayek and his friends and Milton Friedman and so on had left lying around, picked up first of all by Ronald Reagan, and in this country by Margaret Thatcher, and then enthusiastically implemented by Reagan's successor, Bill Clinton, and indeed in a strange way in the UK by Tony Blair and Co. The idea that somehow governments have kind of can't hack it anymore, okay? That everything worthwhile has to be, if you want something done, you outsource it to a corporation. And in the process, over a long period of time, we've hollowed out the capacity. The actual we suffer from state incapacity, and if you wanted a good case study of that in relation to the UK, just think of the COVID crisis. We actually had some state capacity, but it wasn't used. Instead of that, a lot of it was outsourced to corporations, some of them on a corrupt basis, clearly, but you had to watch this disaster unfolding while a state could think of nothing else to do except kind of give it to their mates. in corporations, or we and that mindset still infects ruling elites in liberal democracies. And if things are going to change, then that has to change somehow. And the second thing is that I think, again, it's an ideological shift, which is that the prevailing mindset under which liberal democracies work is that technology drives history. The big tech companies are the ones driving the future, and so on. And and they're engaged in the Schumpeterian process of creative destruction. And the state's role, democracy's role, is to be like the guy who used to walk behind the elephant in the Indian Raj, sweeping up. That's the state's role as far as these people are concerned. And for a long time, that's actually been implicitly the view of our ruling elites. Okay. The actual mindset that's needed is this technology is a really good idea, and it has great possibilities for societal improvement and for prosperity and other things. But democracies are going to say this is the stuff we will allow, and this is the stuff actually we will regulate, and sometimes this is the stuff that will send you to jail. Now, you cannot imagine anybody in contemporary politics who'd be able to come up with that kind of proposition. But that's what is needed. Otherwise, we will wind up with uncontrollable corporate power loose in our societies, and we will happily still call them democracies, but it'll be a kind of joke.
Well, Prof, to conclude, perhaps it'll be on a brighter note, perhaps it won't be. Are there things you'd like to add to what we've discussed? It might be topics that you've touched on, but you want to say something more. It might be things that your humble interlocutor has missed.
The honest answer is I don't. I mean, I have to tell you, I can talk the hind legs off donkeys about this stuff. But you've already expended a good deal of airtime on my particular eccentric views about things. So the answer is no.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much. I really
Thank you.
appreciate that you're agreeing to do this, and I like reading your work, and I've really enjoyed chatting. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been very flattering to be asked.